last 10 years or so, I have been doing a fair amount of work in the field of eminent domain or condemnation. Those are terms which can be really used interchangeably for the purpose of our talk today. Representing primarily public entities, most of my work is done for public entities, however I do some work for landowners as well. I was asked to come speak today. I understand there are people from different disciplines here, but there are a number of people who do either right-of-way work or work with tax collection, assessment of taxes, etc., and was asked to come in to talk a little bit about the eminent domain process and also some of the related tax issues that go along with the eminent domain process. And it's a very broad, complex area. I'm going to a seminar on it in the Bay Area in December, which lasts for 2 days, but I only get half an hour to speak today. So we're just going to hit on some of the high points of what goes on. Yeah. You probably don't want me to speak for two days solid. Condemnation, looking at some of the basics of what condemnation is, it's really a power that goes probably back since the beginning of civilization, when you had a warlord or chieftain or king who decided that they wanted some property, they just went and took it. And that's the way it was for centuries until about the 1200s when Magna Carta came around and the English king recognized that, well, I can't take property unless there's the consent of the owner or the rule of law is followed. We jump ahead several hundred years into the U.S. Constitution, and the late 1700s, the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution was enacted, and specifically addresses eminent domain, makes a number of changes in it. Eminent domain is not simply the taking of property. The Constitution specifies that private property can be taken only for a public purpose, and there needs to be a payment of just compensation. That's the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Those requirements are followed along in the California Constitution as well, which tracks that language. Basically, again, private property can be taken for a public use only upon payment of just compensation. And over the years, there developed a pretty thorough statutory set of rules and regulations governing the condemnation of property, and that's contained within the Code of Civil Procedure of California. So that's the origin of the power, but there's still a number of basic questions that come up in regards to eminent domain. One of the first ones is, who can condemn property? Not just everyone can, but traditionally you think in terms of a public agency condemning property. A city might want property for a city hall, a library, a street. The state might need it for a highway. There might be a water district that needs it for some pipelines. Traditionally, that's the type of agency that would condemn property. But it's not limited to public agencies. There is a group of agencies or entities known as quasi-public agencies. Yeah, that might be an investor-owned public utility, a railroad, a mutual water company, a group of homeowners that have gotten together and formed their own corporation to provide water. By statute, these type of organizations have the power to condemn property. And you go beyond that even, there are provisions in the law that individual people can actually condemn property. It's rare. I've never seen it, but it is there. A couple provisions relate to if a homeowner shows an extreme need to acquire an easement to provide utility service to their property, the homeowner can, through the local government, institute an eminent domain act. Similarly, a homeowner who maybe needs access to a neighboring property to do repair work. There are provisions which would allow that private person to proceed with an eminent domain action. So as I'll talk a little bit later in regards to taxation, you certainly can't assume that just because there's a condemnation or an eminent domain action that a public entity is the one behind it and that property will not be subject to taxation at the end of the day. The next question that can come up, basic question, what kind of property can be condemned? it really is broad as the imagination as to the types of property that can be condemned. Typically, you might think in terms of acreage, maybe put a school on, a library on, but it's not limited. There are all sorts of different property rights. There have been cases where a water company might condemn water rights. Mineral rights can be condemned. A roadway may be needed, so a city could condemn an easement to allow the road for access to travel over a larger parcel. There could be instances where you want to condemn a piece of property to prevent the owner from putting buildings on it that might block light, that might block view. That's possible. You could bring a condemnation action for that as well. There is even a case several years ago, which you may have heard of, where a city attempted to condemn a football franchise. It was never followed through with, but it shows really the unlimited nature of what typically could be condemned, the kind of property that could be condemned. And also, you're not limited if you want to. You might think in terms of condemnation for a school, for instance. You condemn a big plot of land, put it on there. But on the other hand, maybe it's a roadway where you might need just a few feet off a 10-acre parcel. You can do that. There's no requirement that all property be condemned. The agency that is the party doing the condemning is really the master of what it is that it wants to condemn. So it's a very broad, wide area. Another basic question is, why can property be condemned? I mentioned a little while ago the constitutional provisions that state property, private property, can be condemned for a public use. That's the traditional basis for condemnation, a school, a roadway, something like that. On the other end of the extreme, private property cannot be condemned strictly for private use. That's the other end of the extreme. In the middle, you've got this gray area, though, and that's been an area where there's been a lot of litigation lately. Years ago, there was a big Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court case, where a town in Connecticut sought to condemn an older house so that it could be leveled, land given to a private developer to put up a big new housing complex, resort-type complex. The rationale for that is that there was, in fact, the public use. This new use would generate a lot more tax revenue, which in turn would benefit the entire community. And the Supreme Court accepted that rationale. The condemnation was allowed to proceed. It's a little more limited as to what you can do in California, but it still comes up in the context primarily of redevelopment agencies. Perhaps there's an old strip mall, some small piece of land that the agency wants to get rid of the strip mall, wants to combine these odd-shaped pieces of land. They're determined to be blighted, and the purpose would be, in one case, to combine them, tear down the old strip mall, and have a Costco built there. That can be rationalized by the public as a public use, because it is getting rid of blight and increasing the tax revenue again, which benefits all the community. But it's a gray area. It's not certain that that kind of condemnation would succeed. And to the extent that you're an agency representative attempting to go down that road, it's really important to build as strong a case as possible that, in fact, this is for a public use. Or if you're a landowner, you certainly have a lot of ammunition to say, no, this isn't public use. It's just you're giving the land to Costco for a private purpose. Recently, you may recall, in this past June, there was a proposition enacted by the voters, which does place limits on what can be done. This particular proposition, number 99, said that you cannot condemn owner-occupied private residence to give it to a private party. So there are limits, but again, there's lots of room to be creative. So having gone through some of these basic questions, the next issue is really what is the process of a condemnation action? There is a process involved. Contrary to some popular thinking, a public agency just can't go out, demand the property, and say, it's ours now, you're out of luck. First off, there needs to be some preliminary determinations made. As I was talking about, does the agency have the power to condemn? Is there a public purpose? One big issue that the agency has to examine is what is the funding available. The last thing you want to do is spend years, perhaps, lots of engineering, lots of planning studies, and come time to pay for the property and find out, oh, we really don't have the money to do it. Admittedly, there's always some uncertainty, but you don't want to be in that boat, because if that happens, you could potentially, as a public agency, be looking to pay damages to the homeowner after going down the road of condemnation for a considerable amount of time and all of a sudden saying, no, we decided not to. So up front, determining funding is a big issue. Another issue that must occur, another preliminary determination, is there needs to be an accurate determination of what property is needed for the particular public project. Again, the last thing you want to do is spend years and lots of money trying to get a hold of the property for a particular project. You get ready to start turning dirt and you realize, in order to do this, we really need to have another easement to put some utility lines in, or we're digging a trench and we need to use the adjoining property to put the dirt on while the trench is open. You might find yourself, if you don't have a cooperative landowner, all of a sudden looking that you don't have the right property rights. And if the landowner is not cooperative, you got to go back to square one to get that new property. Could be a several-year process. Could place the timing of the project in doubt. It may sink the project because of timing issues. It may sink the project because funding is no longer there. So at the very beginning, you want to make sure that you've adequately defined the property and that when you describe the property, the plat legal description mapping is all accurate. Again, last thing you want to do is think you've got a piece of property to do the project. You start turning dirt and find out that our legal description is all wrong and we really don't have the property we thought we had. That's not a good position to be in. Let's say you go through all that though. You've made your preliminary determinations. You're ready to roll. What's the first step in the process? As you may recall, the one constitutional provision is that just compensation be paid. So one of the very first things as part of the process that needs to be done is the agency needs to go out and hire an appraisal to get an appraisal to determine what is the compensation, what is this property worth. At that point as well, the landowner is going to know what's going on because the agency has to give the landowner notice that their property is being appraised and that the landowner has the ability to come with the appraiser on an inspection of the property. Which is really a good thing. It gives the landowner a chance to go out there, explain anything special, anything unique about the property, and help the appraiser really come up with an accurate, true value. Once you have that appraisal, then you're required. You can't just go to court then and say, here's our value, we're taking the property again. You're required to engage in a period of negotiations with the landowner. There's no set time limit for these negotiations. The rule of thumb is it generally must be at least 30 days. Sometimes it can last weeks, months, even years that you're trying to reach a negotiated settlement. It's generally best for everyone if there is a negotiated settlement, and the law really encourages that there be a negotiated settlement. One recent change to the law which benefits landowners is the public agency has to offer up to $5,000 to the landowner so the landowner can go out and get his own appraisal, which again is a good thing. It helps ground things in reality. It's not a landowner thinking my property is worth millions and this is the big payday. You've got a couple of experts out there who've looked at the property. They have values in mind and you can do some serious negotiations based upon that expert opinion. But let's say these negotiations don't work. What's the next step? The next step is really when you have to get serious about going down the litigation road. And that occurs when the public entity, the board of the public entity, is presented with something called a resolution of necessity. And that's basically a resolution that the governing board adopts saying that it is authorizing an eminent domain action to be filed. There are three particular findings that the public agency's board must make. The board must find the public interest and necessity require the project, that the project is located or planned in the manner that will be most compatible with the greatest public good and the least private injury, and that the property described in the resolution is necessary for the proposed project. Those are findings that must be made. In addition, prior to adopting a resolution of necessity, the agency must comply with state environmental laws, CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act. Perhaps there needs to be an environmental impact report prepared. That's got to be done before condemnation can proceed. The owner must have a right to appear before the governing board at this point to state any objections he or she has to the condemnation. He must be given advance written notice of the hearing and say given this right to speak. Assuming the governing board decides that the criteria have been met, condemnation can only occur if the governing board passes this resolution of necessity by a two-thirds vote. So it is a rather stringent process that must be followed before someone can just go out and file a condemnation action. But let's say that all occurs. What's the next step? The counsel for the agency now has the authority to go out and file the eminent domain action, which is really the next step in the process. The action is filed in the Superior Court of the county where the property is located. The action, the complaint, must include a map of the property that's being condemned. All people who potentially hold any interest in the property will be named as parties to that action. That typically involves taking a close look at title reports. As again, another pitfall, the last thing you want to happen is go through this process, acquire property, say you're acquiring property for a school, and after you do that, you find out that other person who you didn't name in the litigation has an easement running straight down the middle of the site. What that means is then you've got to negotiate with this new property owner to get a release of the easement before you can build the school. Could delay the project, could jeopardize funding. You don't want to do that. It's important to get anyone who has an interest, and that would include also if there are any special districts that have assessments that might be due, taxing agencies, agencies such as that. You don't need to name the county, but other than that, particularly if someone has an assessment on the project, you're going to want to name that entity. Along with filing the complaint, the attorney for the agency is going to report a list pendants to the county recorder's office. This will mean that the presence of the eminent domain action will now appear in title reports, and basically the world's going to be on notice that there's this pending action out there, and in all likelihood, the public agency will be acquiring the subject property at some point in the future. A couple things that can also happen when the complaint is filed. The agency can deposit with the state treasurer the amount of probable compensation. Basically, that's the appraised value. It's deposited with the state treasurer at the time of filing if the agency so chooses. A couple of reasons why the agency might want to do this. For one thing, once the deposit is made, it establishes the date of valuation for the property. Up until recently, that was a really good thing. You want to establish that date of valuation right at the time the deposit is made, not wait a year or longer until trial occurs because property keeps going up. And this provides certainty to you as to what the valuation date will be and helps you better evaluate what the value will be. It's not as crucial in this market, but there's still lots of advantages for doing that because it does provide certainty. You do know at that point when the date of valuation is. Another thing which I'll speak of in just a minute, if the agency is going to be getting possession prior to a final judgment, it must file the deposit with the state treasurer. Once the deposit's filed, the landowner is free to withdraw that money. So the landowner then can withdraw the entire amount. The landowner can also say, wait, that's not enough money, it ought to be increased. But it is available there for the landowner to withdraw. Another thing that the agency can do at any time once the complaint is filed is the agency can move to get an order of prejudgment possession of the property. Basically, this means if the court grants it, the agency can get out there and start working on the project and does not have to wait until the end of the litigation. It's frequently used. A lot of times, by the time you get around to filing the eminent domain action, the agency's ready to go with the project, the funding's lined up, and it doesn't want to wait until this whole process is resolved. Now, some of you may have been involved with some of these prejudgment orders in the past. In the past, it was a pretty straightforward process for an agency to get possession. Basically, they give the landowner 24 hours notice, they go to court and file an application, and they could get possession within 3 days. That all changed a couple years ago. It's become a much more difficult process. Now, if an agency wants to get possession of the property, it needs to file a motion with the court, and the hearing is not set for 60 to 90 days down the road, depending upon whether the property is occupied. The owner then has 30 days to file any objections to the prejudgment possession by the agency. Hearing is held. The court will then order possession, if the order is granted, 10 to 30 days after the order is granted, depending upon whether the property is occupied or not. Although there is a conflict in the statute, there's another different statutory provision that says before an owner is required to move, he must be given 90 days notice. So it could be after the order is entered by the court, there's an additional 90 days. In addition to that, the new law has changed around some of what the agency has to show in order to get possession. The agency now has to show that there's a need for possession and that the balance of hardship favors granting of immediate possession. So the bottom line is, with these changes in the rules, for those of you that do work on behalf of an agency, it's not nearly as certain that the agency is going to get prejudgment possession. It's entirely possible that the agency will not get possession until the end of the day, until the litigation is over, which is obviously something that's got to be planned and factored into the schedule of the project. Once all the pretrial work is done, basically the case moves forward towards a trial. Condemnation trials cannot occur until at least a year after the complaint is filed. Typically, it occurs much longer after the complaint is filed. We filed one on behalf of the city back in December of 06. We just recently learned that our trial at the earliest is going to be in July of 09. So you're looking at perhaps 2.5 to 3 years before the case goes to trial. Prior to trial, there's an exchange of information between the experts, the appraisal information. As you get near trial, agency makes a final offer, the owner makes a demand. If there are any challenges to the basic ability of the agency to acquire the property, the judge hears those. However, as a matter of constitutional law, it's the jury that determines how much compensation is paid. Typically, the jury will hear from both appraisers. It could go with one side, go with the other, or what typically happens, they go somewhere right in the middle. There's a whole series of restrictions as to what can and can't be used in appraising property and what's a proper basis for any opinion. The one relevant, I think, today is that the assessed value of the property is not the proper basis for the appraiser to use in making an opinion of the property. It can't be based on the property's assessed value. The owner can also seek other damages. If, for example, you've got 10 acres and the agency's taking a little 3-foot strip, if the owner shows that the balance of his property is being damaged, the owner can get what's called severance damages, the reduction in value of the other part of the property. If a business is damaged, if goodwill suffers, there can be goodwill damages. But at the end of the day, jury comes back with a verdict, court issues a judgment. Agency also has to pay certain court costs as well as interest. Although typically each side has to bear their own attorney's fees, the court will look at how the final verdict compares with the agency's final offer, and it's possible that the court could order the agency to pay the owner's attorney's fees and also expert fees. The agency cannot, the reverse isn't true, the agency cannot recover those from the owner. Agency will then pay the final judgment. There will be what's called a final order of condemnation entered by the court. That is what's recorded with the county recorder, and it's that document that then passes title to the agency. A couple of points I will note. There are recent changes to the law, even post-judgment. It's possible if the agency does not use the property, does not anticipate using the property within 2 years, it must offer to lease it back to the prior owner on a 1-year lease basis. Also, if the agency does not use the property within 10 years for the stated purpose, it can be required to offer the property to be sold back to the prior owner, or can offer a, or it can be sold as surplus. That is just a real quick rundown of the condemnation process. What I'd like to do also then is talk a little bit about some of the tax issues that are involved with this. Again, it's a very long, complicated process, so this is just simply an overview. As many of you probably know, property owned by public entities is generally exempt from taxation, the theory being that it's the state that owns the property and the state doesn't tax itself. But you can't assume just because there's a condemnation action that in fact the public entity owns the property. As I noted earlier, it could be a private person, could be a quasi investor utility, for instance. You need to look at who actually takes title of the property to see whether or not it's subject to taxation. Additionally, if the public entity is acquiring property outside of its boundaries, and some entities are permitted, a lot of entities are permitted to do that, the property remains subject to taxation. That comes into play, for example, one of the counties buying up water rights outside of its particular boundaries. The county where the water rights were, where the property was losing revenue, and so that was a fix of that problem. Additionally, structures. If structures are on the property or if structures are replaced and they're outside of the agency's boundaries, they're subject to taxation. However, after the agency acquires it, if it puts new structures on the property, they're not subject to taxation. Property can become exempt, however. Let's say a city purchases land outside of its boundaries for a park. When at some point in the future, the city annexes that property into the city, it becomes exempt. Another twist to all this is a public entity might own property. Normally, it wouldn't be subject to taxation. However, if it leases out a portion of that property, say the county owns an airport, leases part of it to a McDonald's, a Burger King, the leasehold possessory interest is subject to taxation. How does all this work as far as dividing up taxes? There's an apportionment of taxes, and that occurs at the earliest of when the conveyance is recorded. When possession occurs by the entity, or when the entity is authorized to take possession. Basically, from that point onward, assuming the property is now exempt, there are no taxes collected from it because it's owned by the public entity. Prior to that date, the former owner is liable for any taxes, and the former owner is also liable if there are any liens for unpaid taxes. Those amounts of monies can be taken out of any judgment, any award in eminent domain, or they could be collected separately. Additionally, there are times when, for instance, I mentioned, say, your agency was acquiring a small strip off of a much larger parcel. Previously, those weren't assessed separately. Any party can request that they now be assessed separately because they have two different owners. Briefly, I would also like to mention that there are benefits to the owners upon acquisition by a public entity. The owner may be able to transfer over the base year value, provided that the owner is displaced from the property and the new property is considered to be comparable property. There's a rule by the Board of Equalization, Rule 462-500, that goes into detail how all that occurs. It basically is a matter of looking at whether the comparable property is similar in size, utility, function to the former property. Size refers not so much to the acreage, but it refers to the value. Is the new property within 120% value of what was received for the old property? Whether or not it's similar in function and utility is very broadly defined. And also, there needs to be actual displacement. You can't take advantage of this basis transfer if there's just a threat of condemnation. That doesn't work. There has to be actual displacement. That is shown by a certified copy of the deed, by the final order of condemnation, or the rules say that's certified. That's shown also by a certified copy of the order of possession. Certified recorded copy. The only problem is I have never recorded an order of possession and I have not seen one recorded. So there's a bit of a disconnect there. I don't know why it couldn't be recorded. It's just something that's not typically done. And I looked at Caltrans rules. They have a detailed right-of-way manual, and they don't reference any at any time the recording of the order. So if that situation arises, that's something you would probably want to talk with the attorneys involved and see if, in fact, it could get reported. That way it would comply with Rule 462. A couple of other things. Titles for both properties must be in the same name, and there's generally a four-year period to take advantage of this. One final point to touch on, given all this, how do county officials, tax collectors, assessors, auditors, how do they know that all of this transaction is occurring? There is a provision in eminent domain law. Prior to judgment, the court is supposed to send out notice to the tax collector asking for information about the property, its assessed value, its any taxes that are due, current taxes, so that when judgment comes around, any past due, any taxes that are owed can be taken care of in the judgment. There are also provisions. The condemning agency is supposed to give notice to the auditor and assessor when there's been a change of, when there's been a need to reapportion taxes. They're supposed to give an instrument evidencing the acquisition by the agency, requesting apportionment, giving the date of apportionment, including a map. Similarly, the tax collector is supposed to be notified of the project that might involve condemnation and when that's likely to occur. That doesn't always occur, though. Those notices don't always occur. There's no penalty, no remedy for failure to give those notices. It doesn't defeat the acquisition. It doesn't defeat exempt status. So that's just something that doesn't always occur. One thing that you can do, to the extent that you do monitor recordings, you can see if a list pendants has been recorded by a public agency. That tells you that something could be afoot, that coming down the road there could be an acquisition. Likewise, recorded deeds, recorded final orders, things of that nature would provide you with information that something is coming down the road. One nice thing is a lot of counties now, their court systems have all their filings available to the public online. If you see a list pendants that lists the court name that gives a potential acquisition, you can then go look up that court case to see if any final order's been filed, see if any order of possession has been filed. That's a quick rundown. There are lots of other interrelated topics. Federal condemnation is an entirely separate subject. A person having land condemned is entitled to relocation benefits. The IRS also has regulations regarding tax consequences. Separate topics for another day, I guess. I did give you a handout with an outline of what I spoke about today, a summary of the condemnation process, as well as some of the rules governing taxation of acquisitions by public agencies. So the one final remark I'd like to make, though, is, as you may know, this is all a very fluid area. There have been a number of statutory changes in the past few years, propositions enacted. Not aware of any pending propositions, but as the new legislature kicks in, new elections come up, this is an area that's always subject to change. So with that, as I said, I think my time is pretty much, if not totally, up, so I would like to thank you all for inviting me here today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, or in the handout, there is some contact information. Feel free to call or email. Thanks.